My name is Larry Rasmussen. Yesterday we spent some time on the basic framework that has evolved through the years of Christian thinking about war and peace, and we highlighted especially the pacifist and the just war traditions. Today I want to deal with the pastoral letter of the Roman Catholic bishops that was voted upon in its final form in May. We're a little bit short of time. Listening to the Northwoods Quintet is always a delight, and I could have gone on through this session with them. I am given to a kind of philosophical mood, I must say, after listening to them and facing the issues of war and peace. There are many mornings when I wake up and I think to myself, or listen to a concert, and I think to myself, there is the possibility that that could be gone, that there wouldn't be a time to make that kind of foolish music together. So there is a kind of connection here that renders one philosophical. But let's move to the Roman Catholics, Roman Catholic bishops' letter. I will, a little bit later, since I don't see the board at hand, put an address on the board for you if you want to get a copy of the letter. It's entitled The Challenge of Peace, God's Promise, and Our Response. The bishops regard themselves in the Roman Catholic Church as bishops in the New Testament sense of the word, that is, as teachers and as moral and spiritual guides. And this is a pastoral letter. Why do we address these matters fraught with such complexity, controversy, and passion, they ask? We speak as pastors, not politicians. We are teachers, not technicians. We cannot avoid our responsibility to lift up the moral dimensions of the choices before our world and nation. The nuclear age is an era of moral as well as physical danger. We are the first generation since Genesis with the power to virtually destroy God's creation. We cannot remain silent in the face of such danger. Why do we address these issues? We are simply trying to live up to the call of Jesus to be peacemakers in our own time and situation. It is a pastoral letter, a teaching letter. It is non-binding, but it carries much weight. That, when you say it's non-binding, that means that one can be a good Catholic, a Catholic in good standing, and have another position from the bishops. Now, there are some subjects where one cannot be a Catholic in good standing and disagree with the bishops, and that's a matter, we don't need to talk about that, but that would be where a letter has binding authority. This one is non-binding, but it carries great weight in the church. It is the occasion now for study in every diocese of the Roman Catholic Church, and a great deal of work is being done to give it not only wide dissemination and study, it also becomes a basis for the U.S. Catholic Conference for its stands on such issues. It has also received interesting reception outside the Roman Catholic community. Holly Wells, a garbologist, handed me an article just now, and it's the bishops speak, the United Nations listens. The Disarmament Times roving reporter, that's the name of a newsletter, took to the halls during this year's Disarmament Commission session, asking in the corridors of the United Nations this question: what do you think will be the impact of the United States Catholic Bishops' pastoral letter on war and peace? Nobody said, what letter? Responses ranged from astounding to, I'm sorry, I cannot comment on a domestic U.S. matter. For the latter reason, all comments were made off the record and are identified only by region in this article. One diplomat declared that the letter was more important than all 59 resolutions of the last General Assembly. So this is being received far and wide. I want to share with you a reception of a major Protestant Christian ethicist, John Bennett, the Bishop's Pastoral of Response, published in Christianity in Crisis. John Bennett is kind of regarded as a sort of dean of American Christian social ethicists. Our perceptions concerning the religious and moral meaning of nuclear weapons and nuclear war can never be the same again. The core of what the Roman Catholic bishops have said in their pastoral letter is that nuclear weapons should never be used in the ways in which governments are preparing to use them. Many of us have known this in our hearts, but we have refrained from saying so because we did not want to undercut deterrence. We'll talk about that subject a little later. I have said it only once in this journal, and I half apologize for doing so because I did not want to make deterrence less credible. Today, there is less confidence than formerly that the structure of nuclear deterrence will prevent nuclear war, and there is awareness that our government is building up nuclear armaments not only to deter, but also to fight a war. The bishops have unusual visibility, and their initial influence will be great because of their own vast constituency. They can persuade people outside that constituency because they did not issue an ecclesiastical edict, which would depend for its authority on their role as bishops. It's even non-binding, as I said, for Catholics. They came to their position by a process that non-Catholics, both religious and secular, can appreciate. It included three drafts, open discussion, listening to people from all sides, and final debate among themselves that the public could bear. Let me just interject at this point a word about that process. The bishops appointed a committee of five of their own ranks to serve as the committee to draft a document. That committee of five included the spectrum of views within the Roman Catholic Church on the issues. So, for example, Bishop Gumbleton was one of the members. Bishop Gumbleton is a member of Pax Christi, which is a Roman Catholic pacifist group, and he's a spokesperson for that. But on the other side, you had the bishop who was in charge of the military ordnance. So in effect, the kind of chief of chaplains, and closely associated with the military, and was held views widely shared in the military on these issues. That represents a spectrum. They appointed a five-person commission. Then they held hearings with people on all sides, people regarded as experts. So people from the Reagan administration, former members of the Carter administration, the Pentagon, people speaking for non-governmental organizations who have various points of view, etc. It went through, as was just mentioned, three drafts. Between each draft of the letter was circulated for open discussion and for response. The staff then took the responses, informed the committee, and it was changed over the course of time. The bishops themselves got in, of course, on the revisions. This happened over an 18-month period of time, and then in May of this year, it was adopted by all of the bishops of the U.S. by an overwhelming majority. The vote was 238-9. So, on with John Bennett's appreciation. He's just saying that it was a process that non-Catholics and others could appreciate. They do not merely respond to the higher authority of the Pope, but go beyond what the Pope has said, though perhaps not his spirit. They differ from bishops in some other countries because they speak as citizens of one of the two superpowers that have vast nuclear armaments and may be tempted to use them. They draw out the implications of traditional teachings about the just war, which Roman Catholics have most fully developed, but which many others share, by reasoning that people of many traditions can follow to show that a nuclear war could not meet the criteria of a just war. I'll add parenthetically again that the tradition of just war thinking is based on criteria which are a kind of common sense criteria, one and which can be affirmed by people coming from various religious as well as non-religious traditions. There isn't anything in the just war tradition that says you have to believe thus and so about God, Jesus, the Holy Spirit in order for this position to make sense. It in fact developed out of Greek philosophy, Plato and Aristotle and on down the line. That's very wise if you want to reach as wide a constituency as possible, because it's a position which has integrity in light of Christian faith, but it can be acceded to by people of all religions and ideologies. And the Roman Catholics' bishops chose the just war tradition then as a way of entering into a wider public debate. They might not have been able to do that had they taken a position which said, this follows from Christian faith, and you can only understand it if you're coming from the inside. So that's John Bennett's point here, that many people of many traditions can follow their argument. Their influence is the greater because no one can even raise the question of their being influenced by propaganda or pressure from the Soviet Union. Already there have been statements from persons of religious faith from other traditions that indicate there is readiness to accept what is basic in the letter. Last November, the Council of Methodist Bishops sent a telegram to the National Conference of Catholic Bishops expressing thanks to God, quote, for your courageous witness on behalf of peace and justice, end quote. It is more remarkable than that the American Academy of Religion, which includes many hundreds of theologians of various traditions and which is not an advocacy organization, declared at its annual meeting last December, quote, we wish to state publicly our conviction that the use of nuclear weapons under any circumstances is contrary to the faith and the fundamental moral values of the religious traditions of mankind, end of quote. Immense and baffling problems of statecraft remain, and they will not be immediately affected by the movement of thought stimulated by the bishop's letter. But that gives people in the churches no excuse to continue to tell one another and the nation that it may be within religious and moral bounds, even in retaliation, to devastate another nation with nuclear bombs, either by attacks on cities or by attacks on military targets, the side effects of which could mean the destruction of many millions of people and serious damage even to the global environment. Sometimes the inference is drawn from the tradition of Christian realism, that's the background of this particular journal, that nothing really new can be expected in the behavior of nations. Something new has happened. Never before has humanity been threatened by self-destruction, which may be irreversible. Always before, it was expected that new generations could have fresh starts, and always before, it was possible to find relief from the worst destruction by seeking another place. This radical change of circumstances requires from nations a new response. That ends John Bennett's comment. The inference of the last sentence is that the Roman Catholic bishops have helped us in beginning a new response. Now, why this letter in the first place? The reason is the failure of arms control policy. We've had a series of treaties. There have been negotiations for a long time in Geneva, but arms control as a way of controlling arms has failed. That doesn't mean we don't keep at it, but it is the historical failure of that elicited the response and the increase in the threat of the nuclear arsenal. I'm going to use something to show the threat. It is not from the Roman Catholic bishop's letter, but it is indicative of that which elicited that letter. If the light is good enough for you, you can see this chart that has blocks. There are 144 blocks in there. It's like looking at one of those ceilings with the acoustical pins in them. In the center is a block with only one pinpoint on it. That one pinpoint represents all of the weapons detonated during World War II. 3 million tons of TNT, or what are called 3 megatons. Each of the dots that you see is the equivalent of 3 megatons, or all of the weapons detonated in World War II. The total number of dots that you see there represents the destructive power of the present nuclear arsenal in place. There are then some 18,000 megatons whereas in World War II, the total was 3 megatons. So you're talking about destructive power in place now that represents 6,000 World War IIs. These little dots down in the corner here surrounding some of the dots, as a little circle enclosing some of the dots in one of these 144 blocks, is the destructive power carried on one Trident submarine. It is sufficient to incinerate 300 major cities in the world. That's one sub. If you placed a dime on this chart, you would cover the dots that represent enough nuclear weapons to destroy all major and medium-sized cities in the world. That's what, together with the failure of arms control, elicited the Roman Catholic letter. Yes?
Better way of putting that, Hiroshima, the nuclear availability right now is 1.25 million Hiroshimas.
Yeah. The Hiroshima bombs do not even qualify for the SALT agreements because they're too small. All of the bombs that are covered in the SALT treaties are larger than the Hiroshima ones. Okay, that's the occasion for this. Now, a little more about the process. It's obvious that in this amount of time, we'll not have opportunity to summarize the letter, so I'm going to talk a bit about the letter and its significance and its reception, and then get to as much of one topic as we can. The process has put to rest an initial suspicion. The initial suspicion, in the words of one of the columnists in the Washington Post, a very respected columnist by the name of Edwin Yoder, he wrote, "What do bishops know of bombs?" That was an initial suspicion, that the Roman Catholics didn't know what they were talking about. He said in that column, "The opinion of bishops on the fine points of nuclear deterrence is approximately as valuable as the opinion of generals on the fine points of transubstantiation." After the draft came out and it got a close scrutiny, that suspicion that the bishops don't know about bombs was put to rest. And you had the answers that came with someone like Stanley Hoffman in the Boston Globe. Stanley Hoffman is a professor at Harvard and is regarded as one of the leading experts on arms policies in not just the United States, but in the world. He had this comment under an article in the Globe entitled "Bishops Grasp Complex Issues." The draft, this is not the final one now, but the third, the draft shows a highly expert awareness of the complexity of nuclear issues, of the delicate relations between deterrence, that is, the threat and capability to resort to nuclear weapons in case of enemy attack, and the actual willingness to use nuclear weapons should deterrence fail. of the different doctrines of nuclear war aimed either at cities or at military targets, of the distinction between general and limited nuclear war, of the crucial distinction between deterrence of the nuclear attack and extended deterrence, in other words, deterring through nuclear means a conventional enemy of one's allies. And it goes on to talk about other aspects of the document. But the point was that the suspicion that the bishops didn't understand the insides of the arms policy was put to rest. The mail and the comments to the initial drafts of the letters was astounding in its affirmation from the community of expertise on nuclear arms, and astounding in that they found nothing in error in the bishop's letter as to understanding what arms policy has been about. There are disagreements. They are disagreements of judgment and conclusions. There were not disagreements on technical and policy matters. Would that the generals will do so as well on matters of transubstantiation. The outline. There are three major areas that the bishops address. They are these: scriptural and theological perspectives on war and peace, issues of public policy and strategy, and pastoral approaches for developing the role of Christians as peacemakers in the modern world. Those three topics are organized in four sections. The first section of the letter is on biblical and church perspectives on war and peace. It's kind of a theology of peacemaking. The second section is on war and peace in the modern world. Here the center is on nuclear arms policy in the present, especially U.S. policy, but also USSR policy, and then their judgments about that. The third section is a section entitled The Promotion of Peace, Constructive Proposals. Where ought we to go from here? Let's not just criticize. What now and what next? And then the fourth section is a pastoral challenge to Roman Catholics in particular, to the church at large, and then their sections, to public officials, to educators, to scientists, to Roman Catholics working in defense industry, to parents, to youth. That's a common characteristic of pastoral letters, to address each of the audiences within the church. And then finally, there are endnotes. I mention that because the notes themselves are education in the whole area. Since we're short on time, let me just give you a touch of the letter by citing a portion of the conclusion. What are we saying? Fundamentally, we are saying that the decisions about nuclear weapons are among the most pressing moral questions of our age. While these decisions have obvious military and political aspects, they involve fundamental moral choices. In simple terms, we are saying that good ends, defending one's country, protecting freedom, etc., cannot justify immoral means, the use of weapons which kill indiscriminately and threaten whole societies. We fear that our world and nation are headed in the wrong direction. More weapons with greater destructive potential are produced every day. More and more nations are seeking to become nuclear powers. In our quest for more and more security, we fear we are actually becoming less and less secure. In the words of our Holy Father, we need a moral about face. The whole world must summon the moral courage and technical means to say no to nuclear conflict, no to weapons of mass destruction, no to an arms race which robs the poor and the vulnerable, and no to the moral danger of a nuclear age which places before humankind indefensible choices of constant terror or surrender. Peacemaking is not an optional commitment. It is a requirement of our faith. We are called to be peacemakers not by some movement of the moment, but by our Lord Jesus. The content and context of our peacemaking is not set by some political agenda or ideological program, but by the teaching of Jesus' church. And then it goes on further with the conclusions, but I think we'll get to some of those. Now, the letter is extremely compact and complex, as you might expect, since it's been through several drafts. I should say that it started out shorter and it's gotten longer each time, and it ended up being 32 pages of three columns each. I don't know when the last time was that you wrote a letter of 32 pages of three columns each, but that's where they finished. So rather than an effort on my part to kind of summarize something which is already very dense, I will not try to deal with three of the four sections. I'm going to skip the first part, the theology of war and peace, in part because that was what I did yesterday, would be reduplicated by summarizing their point of view. Mine was one which was informed by theirs and is in accord with it. And I'm also going to skip over the sections on the constructive proposals of peace, not because that's not important, and also the last part, the pastoral challenge, and focus instead on the second section, their comments on war and peace in the modern world. If we do have some time for discussion, I hope then we can get to the other sections by way of your own questions. Why choose that second section? When the second draft was made public, it caused a real stir in the Reagan administration and in the media in general because it came out opposing U.S. deterrence policy. And I should say not just Reagan's, but the policy that was also Carter's. William Clark, Reagan's presidential assistant, drafted a lengthy 7-page letter, which he released to the New York Times. It was not a wise move for the bishops to read the letter to them in the New York Times, but that's another matter. I want to pick this up because it's the point at which there's been the most attention. Many assumed that there would be some changes in the third draft because it stood in opposition to the Reagan administration policy as well as USSR policy. Incidentally, many also assumed because of the media play that the chief concern of the bishops for the third draft then would be their response to the media play and the Reagan administration. That was not their chief concern. And there is something interesting. After the second draft, the major items of concern for the bishops were four. I passed this on from the person, Brian Hare, who was the chief drafter of the pastoral letter, in a report to a discussion group of which meets every December, so we had already had the second draft. Brian Hare told us that the bishops were concerned about the following four things, and in this order of importance, what was troubling them as they went now to the final draft? What would they have to work on? First and most important was the internal moral argument, Catholic ways of judging the morality of arms. There was an inconsistency in the second draft. There are different Catholic traditions for thinking about war and peace, and they had put two of them alongside each other which didn't fit together, and Roman Catholics caught it, some of them, and pointed that out. So that's what they had to deal with. That was the most important thing. I'll mention a word about that in a second, what that internal moral argument problem was. The second most important thing that they had to deal with were other bishops. The English and the West German and the Italian bishops have taken stands, not as an extensive pastoral letter, have voiced their judgments about war and peace. They have turned out to be more conservative on the issues than the U.S. Catholic bishops. The English bishops, for example, favoring the deployment of short-range missiles. The West German bishops, despite the peace movement in Germany, also favoring the NATO policy of deploying the Cruise and Pershing II missiles. That was the second thing. What are the Roman Catholic bishops in the United States going to do when other bishops in the global church stand in a different place? Now, the Pope, the Pope has said different things at different times, and we can talk about that, if you wish, why that's so. But the Pope has said a qualified yes to deterrence policy. Now, how can the Roman Catholic bishops in this country say something that the Pope, on deterrence, when the Pope has made a statement and say and have it be something different and in disagreement or at difference with the Pope? So the third problem was the Pope. The fourth problem, and the last, was a response to the Reagan administration. Now, why wasn't that a problem for the Roman Catholic bishops? The reason is that the Roman Catholic bishops were very sure of two things. One, they were very sure of the moral tradition out of which they spoke, namely just war. They knew what their criteria for evaluation were. They'd lived with that with a couple thousand years. They were on solid ground there. Secondly, after these hearings, they knew precisely where the Reagan administration was, and in general, U.S. arms policy. They had by this time grasped the technical and strategic data. Being sure of their moral point of view, being sure of the Reagan administration's point of view, all they had to do was put those two together. So when the Reagan administration, Clark says, "We think you've misunderstood us," they said, "No, we've heard from you. We haven't misunderstood you." Clark said in the letter, "We think we've been misread." And Bishop Bernardin, now Cardinal Bernardin, said, "We'll see who has misread whom." Okay. Maybe I better try to get at this by simply describing this middle section and do it as a way of letting you know what the competence is that's reflected in this letter. In the section on modern warfare, the Roman Catholic bishops talk about the use of nuclear weapons. Let me read a few paragraphs to you from that. "Establishing moral guidelines in the nuclear debate means addressing first the question of the use of nuclear weapons. That question has several dimensions. It is clear that those in the church who interpret the gospel teaching as forbidding all use of violence would oppose any use of nuclear weapons under any circumstances." They're now speaking about the pacifist Christian witness. "In a sense, the existence of these weapons simply confirms and reinforces one of the initial insights of the nonviolent position, namely that Christians should not use lethal force, since the hope of using it selectively and restrictively is so often an illusion. Nuclear weapons seem to prove this point in a way heretofore unknown." Now they go on, having said what the pacifist looks at when on the question of the use of nuclear weapons, they move into the just war tradition. "For the tradition which acknowledges some legitimate use of force, some important elements of contemporary nuclear strategies move beyond the limits of moral justification. A justifiable use of force must be both discriminatory and proportionate." Remember from yesterday, two criteria in just war, really important. Discrimination. Some Some folks are non-combatants and ought not to be the victims in war. And proportionality, that one must use means which are not more destructive than the good which is expected to be attained. Certain aspects of both U.S. and USSR strategies fail both tests, as we shall discuss below. The technical literature and the personal testimony of public officials who have been closely associated with U.S. nuclear strategy have both convinced us of the overwhelming probability that major nuclear exchange would have no limits. On the more complicated issue of limited nuclear war, we are aware of the extensive literature and discussion which the topic has generated. As a general statement, it seems to us that the public officials would be unable to refute the following conclusion of the study made by the Pontifical Academy of Sciences, and they quote, "Even a nuclear attack directed only at military facilities would be devastating to the country as a whole. This is because military facilities are widespread rather than concentrated at only a few points. Thus, many nuclear weapons would be exploded. Furthermore, the spread of radiation due to the natural winds and atmospheric mixing would kill vast numbers of people and contaminate large areas. The medical facilities of any nation would be inadequate to care for the survivors. An objective examination of the medical situation that would follow a nuclear war leads to but one conclusion: prevention is our only recourse." End of quotation. So that's their general perspective. Now, they go on, however, to investigate the various strategies that have evolved over time about the use of nuclear war. Those strategies are three. And then they do a critique, a moral critique of each of these. Counterpopulation warfare, initiation of nuclear war, and limited nuclear war. Counterpopulation warfare is where targeting is on major population centers. And you can imagine what conclusion they come to on that, given the just war tradition. What they say that maybe is hard to take is this paragraph on that one. "Retaliatory action, whether nuclear or conventional, which would indiscriminately take many wholly innocent lives, lives of people who are in no way responsible for reckless actions of their government, must also be condemned. This condemnation, in our judgment, applies even to the retaliatory use of weapons striking enemy cities after our own have already been struck. No Christian can rightfully carry out orders or policies directly aimed at killing non-combatants. We make this judgment at the beginning of our treatment of nuclear strategy precisely because the defense of the principle of non-combatant immunity is so important for an ethic of war, and because the nuclear age has posed such extreme problems for the principle." Okay, so that's a judgment on counterpopulation warfare. I can't summarize all how they arrive at all of this, but it gives you a flavor. Initiation of nuclear war, that's another been considered. "We do not perceive any situation in which the deliberate initiation of nuclear warfare on however restricted a scale can be morally justified. Non-nuclear attacks by another state must be resisted by other than nuclear means. Therefore, a serious moral obligation exists to develop non-nuclear defensive strategies as rapidly as possible." And in the next section on constructive peace proposals, they take up the question of what might be viable non-nuclear defensive strategies. Incidentally, this one, let me just read a couple more sections and then we'll need to close. "It has long been American and NATO policy that nuclear weapons, especially so-called tactical nuclear weapons, would likely be used if NATO forces in Europe seemed in danger of losing a conflict that until then had been restricted to conventional weapons. large numbers of tactical nuclear weapons are now deployed in Europe by the NATO forces and about as many by the Soviet Union. Some are substantially smaller than the bomb at Hiroshima, some are larger. Such weapons, if employed in great numbers, would totally devastate the densely populated countries of Western Europe. Then they go on to say, former public officials have testified that it is improbable that any nuclear war could actually be kept limited. Their testimony and the consequences involved in this problem lead us to conclude that the danger of escalation is so great that it would be morally unjustifiable to initiate nuclear war in any form. The danger is rooted not only in the technology of our weapon systems, but in the weakness and sinfulness of human communities. We find the moral possibility of beginning nuclear war not justified by rational political objectives. So they say no to initiation of nuclear war. Then thirdly, and here I'll have to conclude, it limited nuclear war. Can it be contained? It would be possible to agree with our first two conclusions, counterpopulation, initiation, and still not be sure about retaliatory use of nuclear weapons in what is called a limited exchange. We recognize that the policy debate on this question is inconclusive and that all participants are left with hypothetical projections about probable reactions in a nuclear exchange. Then they go on to list a number of questions. The point of the questions is that conditions are such in the case of warfare that they do not see that it likely that limited nuclear warfare could be kept limited. Unless these questions can be answered satisfactorily, we will continue to be highly skeptical about the real meaning of limited. One of the criteria of the just war tradition is a reasonable hope of success in bringing about justice and peace. We must ask whether such a reasonable hope can exist once nuclear weapons have been exchanged. The burden of proof remains on those who assert that meaningful limitation is possible. Now that was a big debate with Caspar Weinberger and others from the Reagan administration who asserted that one could carry out a limited nuclear war and the limitation could be sustained. We will have to close. The next session is on the concept and development of deterrence policy. It's another point at which there was debate with the present administration. I will summarize by saying that this is not a pacifist document, though in the end on the constructive proposals they say what we must do is explore nonviolent means of defense and nonviolent means of adjudicating conflict. We must also enhance the negotiating powers. And they give constructive proposals to that. There is a tip toward the pacifist contention that much has not been developed, the politics of nonviolence, that can be developed, and they give some outline. It is not a pacifist document. In the end, the Roman Catholic bishops have given a highly qualified yes, and you have to put it in quotation marks, to deterrence policy in this form. Instead of calling for unilateral disarmament, they say, okay, we start with the fact that we do have deterrence policy. It can only remain insofar as it is the beginning point of a stepping down, of a reduction of arms, and then they give proposals for that process. But it cannot be a deterrence policy that it can be joined with any notion of counterpopulation warfare and limited nuclear warfare or initiation of nuclear war.
Yeah. I'm not sure what very brief. But obviously, the capital letter has to be given some consideration. However, you would also agree, I know, that there are lots of room for opinions on this. I think something that happened in Sweden last month has to be taken seriously by Lutherans. And that is at Buffalo, Sweden, at the World Peace Conference. And this may even transcend the past work. I don't know, I can't make a judgment, nobody else can. But 133 of the leading, no second runners, the leading theologians of the Catholic, Protestant, and Orthodox faith met. The upshot of it all was, the theme of the conference was that two things, nuclear weapons, nuclear war can never be justified, okay? Number two, that God never had in his plans nuclear weapons, and they can't resist in God's will. Bishop Crumley, get this, Bishop Crumley and Bishop Preuss, who are your bishops for the most part, I suspect, and one is mine, refused to sign a statement that came out of that 20-day meeting or whatever, and here is why. The larger question obviously was the theme of the conference. They agreed on that. But Bishop Crumley, when asked, why didn't you sign the statement? Only 8 of them didn't sign it. He said, because there are other things that are important. Number one, the document they refused to include a statement that in effect said, civil disobedience is not an answer. See, they refused to include that. They said you should explore civil disobedience as a partial answer to protest. Number two, he said, we refuse to include a statement that reaffirms our brothers and sisters in Christ, many of whom do know, who are serving in the military as part of the peacekeeping. That's what the military is for, peacekeeping. I like that. I like Crumley on the basis of those two statements, and I wouldn't told him so, and I hope he stands pat on it. But your bishop, if you're an LDA member, refused to sign that statement when the larger question, in my point of view, was the theme of the conference. That you think it was the concern. Civil disobedience, right at the military, in D.C. Your bishop, Preuss, and Crumley refused to sign it.
I commend, on precisely those issues, I commend the Roman Catholic letter to you because it does include them in its discussion and seeks for a wide range of Christian perspectives on it. The Roman Catholic Church is a very diverse group. Thank you very much.